Hello. Thank you so much for joining me. This is Ellen Kamei, the Natural Nurse, and welcoming you to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network. We're very happy to be on board with our show here, and as you probably have noticed, we have changed times, and we now will be bringing you the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z every single week on Tuesday at 10 a.m. So that would be great if you're joining us. And if that's not a good time for you, remember that you can always listen to all the shows on PRN on the archive. And that's one of the really special things about this radio show. So hoping that you are enjoying the new format. Now today we have as our guest Laura Hunsberger. Laura?
Yes.
Laura, thanks for joining us. I'm going to give you a nice introduction so our listeners will know who we're listening to here. Laura is the Executive Director of Cornell Cooperative Extension for Nassau County, New York. And that's very close to my heart because I am an alumni of Cornell University. Laura is the Executive Director, and she is past President of the Northeast American Society of Horticultural Sciences and received a master's degree in plant and soil sciences from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. She has authored several scholarly journal articles and has been successful at obtaining grants and contracts since 1996. Laura joined Cornell in 2010 as a plant pathology research support specialist as a member of the Long Island Horticulture Research Center research team. One of Laura's goals is to lead a more concentrated effort of encouraging Long Islanders to include more healthy food produced right here on Long Island locally as a regular part of their diet. Those goals include the support of organic and local agriculture. Laura noted Nassau County's population has a proud agricultural past, but today the county's needs are much more about gaining access to good nutrition, which is known as food security, and also having educational programming opportunities about topics such as gardening, landscaping, and sustainability, which can empower people to better care for themselves and their families in the long run. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
There you are. Now, you are very involved in local agriculture and really deeply involved in the study of plant science. What led you to this interest?
It's more of being in the right place at the right time, as a lot of our careers sometimes evolve. I had been taking classes towards a second bachelor's degree in earth science at SUNY Brockport when I was living in upstate, and I used to drive past a farm every day on my way to class, and once I graduated, I thought I was going to be heading more in the geology direction, but I got a summer job at a farm in Brockport, and my perspective on food, food availability and freshness and preparing fresh food and providing it to underserved communities. I was able to go to farmers markets with the WIC program, the Women, Infant, Children, where they accepted the coupons for the food stamp program at that time. And it opened my eyes to a whole new area of need in the United States.
Yes, there's something that I know you're familiar with called food deserts. What does that mean? It's actually not a desert area. Sometimes it's the middle of the city, in fact.
Right. It's if you do not have access to fresh produce within walking distance from your home. So this is usually when you have a lot of corner markets and bodegas, places that you can only really buy canned or frozen vegetables. And while Nassau is loaded with grocery stores, a lot of these pockets, really, the people do not have access to fresh produce in these areas.
And, of course, then they're going to be choosing really inferior food.
Well, there's a place for canned food and frozen food in everybody's diet, and it is convenient and it is, you know, shelf-stable. And the current processing abilities of companies really does help retain a lot of nutrition, but you just can't beat fresh produce, not only from a nutritional standpoint, but, you know, keeping our communities knowledgeable about where our food comes from. If everybody just thinks things come from the freezer or, you know, packaged chicken, we have a less appreciation for those who actually provide us with the food, with the farmers that are out in Suffolk or in other areas of New York. That's one problem with Nassau now, is that we have lost our connection with food, and people don't fully appreciate where their food is coming from.
And, of course, we're focusing on discussion on Nassau County because you are the executive director of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Nassau County. But I would say everything that you're saying has a much more broad effect, not outside of Nassau County, in other areas as well, because our show, of course, goes all over the world.
Right. I agree with that. There are urban areas and rural areas that are connected in the same way that Suffolk and Nassau are. And a lot of these food deserts that we'd mentioned previously are actually located more in rural areas where people are physically removed from grocery stores and places in which they can purchase food.
And that is wild, because as I travel extensively across the country and also in upstate New York, where I was just recently, I noticed that if you go through an area, let's say that is an Amish area, you see these beautiful, rich dirt farms that have a variety of vegetables growing right within the home garden as well as at the local store level. But yet, in areas where they're producing a lot of, let's say, GMO or genetically modified crops such as corn, they'll have all one crop across the entire farm, and they don't even have local food being generated for their own consumption.
Yes, and it's challenging. When I was with the University of Maryland on the Eastern Shore, it was a predominantly grain-growing area that supported the poultry industry. So you had corn, soybeans, and wheat being grown in rotation year after year after year. And you would just have acres and acres and acres of, while these are beautiful fields, they aren't providing, they're providing feed, not food. So it was a challenge to get even farmers to understand the need for a local food system in an area which is a farming community. It's something that I had not anticipated being a challenge, to get people to produce food for themselves and seek out local food when they themselves are farming.
Well, let's talk more about Cornell Cooperative Extension, CCE, that of course you're involved with, and as I had said earlier, I am an alumni of Cornell University. What role does Cornell University have, or how is it linked to the Cooperative Extension?
Cornell Cooperative Extension is the outreach arm to Cornell University. There is a county office in every county in New York, including New York City and the boroughs, and we provide research-based educational programs to the communities. These programs are based upon community needs. So in a more rural area, there would be more agricultural programs, more maybe water quality, 4-H programs for the kids, showing animals, et cetera. And in the more urban areas, such as where we are in Nassau, we have urban forestry and environmental horticulture and human nutrition. And then we have our 4-H camp out in Suffolk County. So Cornell University provides the educators with the research-based information that then is shared with the community members that attend our educational programs.
Well, let's go into more depth about some of these educational programs, because I think they are excellent. One of my friends is actually the head horticulturist at Planting Fields Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself is very knowledgeable. He's had that job. This is his 40th year on the job. And so he actually does work for New York State, but he thinks that Cornell Cooperative Extension is a wonderful resource. And when he comes up against a problem either related to pest control, which he likes to use integrative pest management to cut down on the use of pesticides and herbicides, if he sees a new species cropping up that may be considered invasive, he finds that Cornell Cooperative Extension is a very reliable go-to resource for him as a professional agriculturist and horticulturist.
It's so good to hear. I have found that as a gardener in my backyard, as well as being a professional in the horticulture industry, I'm fascinated with the depth of knowledge that people have that work for Cornell Cooperative Extension. When I was out in Suffolk at the Long Island Horticultural Research and Extension Center, we have a diagnostic lab there, and we have one here at our East Meadow Farm as well. So people can walk in with an insect, with a plant. They can have their soil tested for pH, for nutritional content. And if you have an insect that you're a little concerned about, especially something that's becoming invasive and problematic, like emerald ash borer or something, you can give it to these experts, and they will diagnose and then give you a possible remedy for managing it. Or sometimes in the fall, as you've probably experienced, when you're inundated with ladybird beetles or ladybugs that are trying to get into your house, some people don't realize that it's just a natural process, that these insects are just trying to go near a food source, or maybe it's breeding season. So I think that the information that Extension can offer to the community can help allay fears as well as help manage problems.
And one of the great things is there's no fee for this service.
Right, that is nice.
People can just reach out to you with a question, and very often if you can't get the answer, you might be able to help them find the answer elsewhere, and there's no fee for that.
Exactly, and with technology these days and digital cameras, you can send photos to colleagues in other states who may have seen a problem similar at a different time in their lives. We have microscopes now that even have cameras attached to them, so you can send pictures of spores and diseases, which normally would be very difficult to transport.
Wow, that's so interesting. See, that's why I love doing radio shows, because that's brand new to me. As a matter of fact, just today, my husband brought home a plant that he dug up, and what it looks like is a wild Datura plant, and we've never seen anything like that. It's actually having the thorn apples hanging off it, as well as the same shaped flowers, which are sort of like upside-down bells, in the Datura that we purposely grow, but this seems to be a wild variety that I've never seen on Long Island before.
I wish I had an answer for you, but I don't.
Right, so we'll send you the picture, you see. So that's really interesting. We don't even have to bring it there.
Right, exactly.
But you can communicate via email and send photos, so that's great. Now, what about the work that you're doing, because you already brought up East Meadow Farm. What is the East Meadow Farm?
It is a 2.5-acre parcel of land in East Meadow, which is on Merrick Avenue, in a very easily accessible area of Nassau County. And it is land that the county has purchased and leased to us for a 10-year lease. And we have developed both a diagnostic and outreach community building and a community garden. So in the community garden, we have right now, we just opened our doors in March or April. We have a phenomenal group of volunteers, master gardeners, as well as community members, the Kiwanis, different groups that have been interested in helping us out. They built 40 raised bed community gardens, and these were then rented by community members. And we're going to be hopefully building 40 more this fall for availability next spring. And it's absolutely crazy over there. We have everything from watermelons and tomatoes and sunflowers and eggplant, peppers, hot peppers and lettuces. Everybody can grow whatever they want. The biggest pest we have over there are the rabbits. So every community garden is sort of fenced in with a little bit of an exclusion to keep the bunnies out. We also have demonstration gardens. We have a rose garden, an herb garden, a beautiful butterfly garden that is just buzzing with activity. And so community members can just, it's a public area. You can just walk through and learn about the different plants that are grown there, see what you might want to grow yourself. And these master gardeners have gone through a very extensive training program. So they are educated on plant care and pest management and can answer questions from people that come and walk through. It's a fantastic resource that we have over there. And as I had mentioned about the diagnostic lab, people can just come in during our open hours of operation. We don't have a very large staff, so we do have it restricted to times when we have master gardeners that are available to man the front desk, and people can bring in insects and plants, soil samples, anything that they may be having a question about.
Wow, that's great information. We're going to take a little break right here, Laura, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Laura Hunsberger, who is the Executive Director of Cornell Cooperative Extension. Stay tuned for more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances, such as cough syrups and digestive tonics, contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnamic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinzenolin and cinzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, the next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
Once again, to the natural nurse as Dr. Z, right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network, here on PRN.FM. Today, we have as our guest Laura Hunsberger. Laura is the Executive Director of Cornell Cooperative Extension, Nassau County, New York. And she has been sharing with us some very interesting information about the many projects that the Cornell Cooperative Extension is involved in. Laura, you were telling us about the East Meadow Farm.
Yes.
So tell us more about the kinds of plants that might be found there. And I want to tell you, I've never seen this, and I am going to stop down myself.
It's so diverse over there. It's really a wonderful collection of all sorts of horticulture. If you like perennials, you can find the gold medal favorites, which is a certain line of plants that are they're released every year, the new varieties that different companies are supporting. We have a rose garden, which plants have been donated by Texas A&M University. We have, as I mentioned before, our butterfly garden. So that contains both perennials and annuals, things that attract not just butterflies, but all sorts of pollinators.
Well, wait a minute. Let's tell our listeners some of the specific plants that might be great to use in a butterfly garden.
On this, but obviously a butterfly bush is one of the ones that has always been popular. Echinacea, the purple coneflower, is another, but I would just be able to scratch the surface if I was to start listing these off. The master gardeners who are the ones who put this garden together, and we have specific groups. So there's a head of the butterfly garden. His name is Ed, and he is passionate about saving seed and sharing seed with the other community members as well as the gardeners to keep these types of gardens popular and thriving.
Well, now we have to move into a little bit of a political discussion, because when you brought up saving seed, and I think saving seed is very important. I have spent a lot of time in indigenous cultures around the world where I visit with some of the elders who have been growing specific species for many years, and I encourage them to save their seeds. It has to do with something called heirloom gardening. And yet, when we look at Monsanto and the entire process of using genetically modified seeds, they are actually going after farmers who do practice seed saving.
My understanding of that is that because if you purchase a genetically modified seed, you sign a contract with the company that has produced it, and that contract prevents you from saving their seed from year to year because it is under contract. It's like copywritten if it was a piece of written work. So I think that there's a time frame in which such as Monsanto can no longer come after Roundup Ready soybeans, but I thought it was 5 years. So as far as seed saving goes and heirloom varieties, that's something that is separate from the GMO issue. Seed saving is a tricky business. Some people have their own special little method for the best way to save and preserve seed, but it is a tradition in many cultures to perpetuate these wonderful breeding lines that have such phenomenal flavor and growing characteristics. As we know, mostly are the heirloom tomatoes are the ones that are most commonly saved and are probably one of the easier seeds to save.
And in terms of heirloom tomatoes, you actually see them even in the regular grocery store. Some of what you can use to describe them is they kind of look funny. They have all kinds of weird shapes and sizes and colors. But yet, the taste is phenomenal.
It is phenomenal. There's nothing like it. I belonged to a CSA, and 1 year, 1 week, we got 11 pounds of tomatoes, most of which were heirloom, since you don't really have much of a control over when these are going to suddenly be ready. We were just inundated 1 week. I think I ate 5 pounds just standing over the sink, since they're so delicate and they don't store well, they don't ship well, they need to be enjoyed as quickly as possible, which is why you find these heirlooms mostly at farmers markets. As you mentioned, you see them in the grocery store, but I think that if you do see them there, you'll see that they're being cared for very uniquely, sometimes on bubble wrap or put into some sort of special plastic sleeve in order to protect their skin, which is sometimes not as tough as the regular tomato that we are used to getting in February.
Well, Laura, you threw out a term that's very familiar to me, but perhaps some of our listeners don't know what that means. Tell us about CSAs.
Oh, CSAs are growing. It stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it is a way of, some people say, putting the face on the farmer. It supports farms in a different manner. So you, as a consumer, would buy a share of a farmer's crop during a specific time period in the growing season. So normally there's a main growing period, which would be in the summer. You can buy a spring share or a fall share. So you would give money to the farmer. They would. You can buy a full share or a half share. You can share it with a friend. And it gives the farmer money up front, so they can buy seed and fertilizer and perhaps even pay people to help them prepare the land and plant what it is that they're going to be growing that year. So you give them your share of money in the spring, maybe even February, and then come May through November, it's common, you will pick up a weekly share of food either at a farmer's market or at a specific drop-off, and you will get a share of the crop. So it obviously depends upon the time of season, and as I mentioned, sometimes you get 11 pounds of tomatoes. But the thing that's important for people to understand is that it allows you to share the risk of farming with the farmer. So if there's a drought, if there's a hurricane and they lose their crop, if there's disease, late blight, they might lose all their tomatoes. You, as a consumer, get a little bit of an understanding as to what the farmer goes through year after year after year. It's a challenging, from a farmer's standpoint, it's a challenging business to be in because you suddenly have a whole lot of bosses and people that are going to say, I have too much kale, I don't want any more butternut squash. But I think as if from a consumer standpoint, it allows you to be, or forces you to be, more creative with your cooking. When I would go to my CSA pickup, I had a couple friends, we would get together that night and we would prepare in advance, look up a bunch of recipes that we wanted to make, and we would bring Tupperware containers, and we would share our food together. And to me, that's sort of what CSAs are about. It brings a lot of people together that you normally probably would not meet. It forms a different sort of community. You have potluck dinners at the end of the season. In this digital age, when we are more separated from people, it really is a wonderful way to bring people together.
Yes, I love them, too. Well, we're going to take another break here so that Progressive Radio Network can let you know some of the other exciting shows that are aired right here and also found on the archive. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Right here to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you are staying healthy. And we're very happy to bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we do a lot of work in the community. So we have classes in Chinatown where you can learn about Chinese medicine, the ancient traditional art of Chinese medicine. We have several of those coming up, and you can get in touch at naturalnurse.com, look on schedule, or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And that's where you'll learn things like tongue and pulse diagnosis, Chinese herbal medicine. And we actually go down into a factory where they prepare different kinds of herbal preparations, and you'll get to see that. We also have a wonderful schedule of lectures, and one that's coming up actually grants CEU credits, and those are college credits. You can use them for any degree, acupuncture, chiropractor, nurse, like myself, the natural nurse, and most professionals do need ongoing CEU credits, and this is coming up at University of Bridgeport. It's a full day of evidence-based natural medicine studies where you can actually learn what is proven in terms of natural therapies. We also have a class where we go out and collect edible and medicinal plants. And that's where we're going to gather them and make them into medicine. So it's a natural medicine making workshop. So that's good. You can join us for that as well. And just get in touch through naturalnurse.com. Go to schedule, and you'll find information about all of those classes. Today, we're very happy to have on board Laura Hunsberger. Laura is the Executive Director of Cornell Cooperative Extension in Nassau County, New York. And she has a very long history in edible plants and research in the field. So I think we're very lucky to have her in Nassau County. And she's was also a research specialist. So tell us about some of the things that you worked on when you were more intimately involved in research projects, Laura.
Well, I think if you're directing your own research, you can be a little bit more choosy as to what crops you want to work on. When I was in Maryland, I would choose things that I liked to eat personally. So I started a variety trial, which would mean trying different types of varieties within the same plant of edamame, the edible soybeans. And that way you actually get to eat your research.
That's funny.
It was a fun crop to grow because soybeans grow very well in Maryland, but they are grown for the poultry industry and not for eating. So it's not the vegetable soybean. It was the grain soybean. So I think variety trials are the sort of thing that anybody can do in their backyard. It's sort of like what we were talking about earlier with heirloom tomatoes. When somebody has, you can grow your regular beefsteak and you can grow it right next to something like a Brandywine or a Cherokee Purple and see how many fruit are produced per plant and how large the fruit gets. You can sort of compare between varieties, and that's fun. When I was working for Cornell out at the research station in Riverhead, I worked with Meg McGrath, who is a world-renowned plant pathologist and very, very involved in diseases of pumpkins. So as we all know, with the time of year coming up, it is approaching pumpkin season, and there are many diseases that affect the quality of the fruit, whether it's the handle, the peduncle, which is always a good word to throw at a party. People always look at you funny. That's what the name of the handle on a pumpkin. And people buy pumpkins for the quality of the handle as well as how the fruit looks and shape. So making sure that you manage the diseases that could affect that specific plant part is part of the research that we would conduct out there.
Pumpkins are certainly well known. Now, let me ask you something about the soybeans.
Okay.
What is the difference, or were you working with, let's say, organic soybeans or genetically modified soybeans, or is there anything in between those two types?
I do not believe there is anything in between. Genetically modified soybeans are grown in order to lessen the amount of work, essentially, that a farmer will have to do as far as pest management goes. So Roundup Ready soybeans has a gene within it that allows a farmer to spray Roundup, which is the trademarked product of glyphosate, directly over the crop, and it won't kill the crop. Normally, glyphosate is a non-selective herbicide, so it, as anybody who has used this knows, whatever it touches, it will kill. And that's for large scale, like acre, huge areas. So if you are growing something like edamame or soybeans for maybe your backyard chicken flock, you'd probably be choosing a variety that is, it would not be genetically modified. It's something that is not easily obtained, I would say, by the normal gardener. So the varieties I was looking at were things that you can find in the regular vegetable catalog. Everything from Johnny's to Fedco had a lot of varieties, and they grow differently. Some are big and bushy, and some are shorter and compact. And I think that the only genetically modified vegetable that you could probably get as a backyard grower would be the BT corn. So sweet corn now has the BT gene in it. BT, if you're not familiar with that, stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, and I'm probably pretty sure I mispronounced it. And it's a bacteria that is naturally occurring, and it only attacks, or only affects, I should say, caterpillars, lepidopterans. So they actually have to eat the plant, the crop, in order for it to affect them. So there are many BT products out there, and these are actually things that can be used by organic growers. So it is, because it is a naturally occurring organism, BT products are, for the most part, able to be used in an organic system. So a BT corn is something that is actually fairly common now, both in field corn and in sweet corn, that you would find at a farmer's market.
I saw an excellent description along with diagrams on how that works in a movie that's actually free for anyone to watch right now online, which is called Genetic Roulette. And you can actually see the movie at geneticroulette.com. And that they really did a good job showing the action of the BT on the insects in terms of sort of exploding their internal organs.
It is a stomach poison. Yeah,
right. It's a stomach poison, and then they were looking at the possible effect on humans who develop what's called leaky gut syndrome, and the possibility of ingesting BT and of having a similar effect on the gastrointestinal tract in humans. That's not proven yet. It's theoretical, but it was a very, very well done movie. It's called Genetic Roulette. And people can watch that on their own. So we don't know if that happens, but who knows. Another interesting thing is that it seems like there are crop pests, that are developing a resistance to BT, which they did not used to have.
Mm-hmm. I have not read the studies that have been supporting that yet, but I'm not surprised. I think that the more widespread a product is, the more chance there is for resistance, that you get that one insect that it doesn't affect anymore, and then it will suddenly reproduce, and you can slowly start strengthening the population against a certain product. We are seeing Roundup-resistant weeds, horseweed for one, in many farm fields, so causing even more problems for the farmers that are using large equipment to go harvest their crops.
Right. It's interesting, too, because when we talk about the soil and when we talk about human health, we always see such parallels. Like in humans, the overuse of antibiotics is what is known to have created antibiotic-resistant strains.
Right.
So we see a similar thing when we're investigating things scientifically on the farm.
Exactly. Very similar types of ecosystems, if you want to call them that. It just shows that diversity in any system is helpful to the success of the human race, that we can't just grow one thing and just use one product in order to be healthy.
Now, when we look at Cornell Cooperative Extension, we mentioned earlier that a lot of the services that you offer are free to the public, and yet, unfortunately, there is a reduction in funding for the extensions activities by the county. So how are we going to continue to offer these services moving forward?
It's challenging. We normally, all cooperative extension offices throughout the United States, to the best of my understanding, are funded through federal, state, and county dollars. And many, many counties are being affected with a reduction of county support. Nassau County is, I think, one of the first in the state of New York that has had zero funding. We do not have a line item in the county budget anymore. However, they have given us East Meadow Farm, which is a wonderful resource, and it will give us opportunities to start raising our own funding. So I do have experience writing grants, so that's one avenue that we're looking at. We are starting to hold fundraisers, which we just had our first one on September 8th out at our 4-H farm, the Dorothy P. Flint 4-H camp out in Riverhead. And it was called the Survival Race, which is a 5K obstacle race, mud race sort of thing, which is so popular these days. So over the 3.1 miles, there were 15 obstacles and I think probably about four mud pits. One which you kind of had to take a face plant in at the very end. And we raised a nice chunk of money at this event, and we're hopeful that it will be something we can do year after year.
Yes, and I did announce that on another radio show that I do because it looked like a wonderful event. So how did that go?
It was dirty.
Because I know you were participating personally.
I did participate. It was very fun. It was challenging. I'm a triathlete for over a decade, and while my training has been diminishing over time, it has changed. This type of event is something that requires a lot more thinking in your deciding how to tackle a certain obstacle. Usually you just get on a bike or strap on your sneakers and go. But this, you had to sort of evaluate before you proceeded, and which I think is just sort of a fun way to get your exercise and get people off the couch. It was a family event, too. The number of people that were under 14, that and as well as over 65, was great to see when I was looking at the numbers. So, yes, we are we're pleased that it went so well, and we are looking forward to holding it again next year.
Now, you have an event coming up at the East Meadow Farm, and I see we're not there yet because it's coming up October 12th to 13th, so I'm putting it on my calendar.
Wonderful.
Why don't you tell us what's going to be going on at the East Meadow Farm that day?
We are having our first fall festival. And we are going to be able to showcase to the public the wonderful demonstration gardens, the community gardens, the work that the master gardeners as well as our staff have been doing over there. So we're going to have everything from pumpkins and hay, as well as educational programs such as container gardening, herb gardening, that people can learn how to do something in a small class and perhaps win a raffle to take that container garden home with them. We're cooperating with the Nassau County Homemakers Association, and they will be teaching some small classes as well as raffling off some of their talented goods that they produce. We're going to be having fresh apples, hopefully local from Long Island, as well as cider. And it's the opportunities we have are endless over at that location. So we're looking forward to two fun days full of school groups as well as community members that can come over and take a look. It'll be about 10 o'clock in the morning till sunset.
Now, you know that there's also the Long Island Fair coming up.
There is, and that is an exciting event that I'm looking forward to attending this year.
I have a farm right by me. It's called Frolic Farm Preserve, which is a beautiful project that actually was brought about by individuals taking the initiative to stop the development of that land by going to town meetings and evoking the fact that in Suffolk County we have a clean air fund available where the county is supposed to purchase any large tracts of air to maintain, I believe, air and water quality. So, you know, they were just going to go ahead and allow that to be sold. It's about 1,000 acres, I believe, in total. And these individuals were able to come together and actually form a organization called Friends of Huntington Farmland. So it was a big project, and they were able to grab this, and now they have a beautiful organic and biodynamic farm that's going on. I guess this is the fourth or fifth year, and every year they win some blue ribbons at the fair.
Wow. I find it amazing how the passion of a few can really rally support to make a big difference in a community, such as an example like that.
Oh, yeah, and they also donate all of their crop harvest to the homeless shelters and pantries on Long Island.
Wonderful.
And that's even not easy, because there seems to be so many regulatory hurdles to get over to even give healthy food away.
That is true. We have a garden bed at East Meadow, which does donate to one of the local shelters. And while I have never experienced it myself, I have heard anecdotally through other groups that there have been issues with certain shelters not being able to accept food that has been donated, and it's unfortunate.
Right, because they want things that are, let's say, prepackaged.
Exactly, and you're losing a lot of nutrition that way.
Right, and so they worked on that. I mean, it's endless, and it's so great to see the development of that farm. Plus, I love it because it's right next to my house, and that's where I walk through 3 miles of trails that they keep up. But it's 100% volunteer.
Wonderful.
Nobody's making any kind of money, but the county did grant them status as stewards over this land, and it's in perpetuity, mm-hmm. so that it's not going to be developed into a housing development in the future. And that's some of the great work that programs like yours do. Now, do you have any kind of program which supports home gardening? Because I've been noticing this year that some people, instead of having a lawn, actually have edible crops right outside in the front of their house.
We offer a lot of different types of educational programs, and edible landscaping is one of the types of programs that we do offer. And I think that, I mean, it is such a growing area. Lee Reich, who is a Cornell affiliate, I'm not sure if he still works for the university or not, has written a fantastic book on edible landscaping, including blueberries and different bramble crops such as raspberries. To everything, so if you need the high type, you need to have your diversity and height with your landscapes. So you need something high like blueberries as well as low, herbs for one, or even a low growing fruit such as strawberries. I think it's a fantastic way to utilize yard space. But then again, you always have to compete with, you know, the birds and the critters that also think that you have a great idea. But yes, edible landscaping is, I think, a very, very growing trend as people are looking to provide themselves with fresh fruit.
Right, and it really is so excellent in terms of that whole concept of the food desert that you discussed earlier. Like my son, who lives in Seattle, does that. He actually grows edible food right in front of his house, as well as have apple trees there. And, you know, someone once said to him, well, aren't you worried that people might steal it? He said, no, I put a sign out front so that anybody who walks by can take all they want. It's not like I don't have enough.
Especially when zucchini season hits.
Exactly. Like you said, please take tomatoes, you know. The thing is, don't you think if there was more local growing that there would be less of an issue in terms of global starvation and even urban food deserts that we experience?
I think that going back to the Victory Garden type of concept where everybody did grow their own patch of produce, I think that would be ideal. But the way that our housing is situated now, sometimes people are in high rises, and maybe the direction of their building doesn't even face the sun. People are limited with both land and time and a lot of resources. But I think that anything that you can grow that you could add to a meal, even if it's just a basil plant on your windowsill, I think is helpful. It makes you feel good to grow things and to play in the dirt. And Will Allen, who is in, I believe, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Growing Power is the name of his company. He spoke at the Small Farm Conference that was held at Hofstra University this past spring, and he makes raised bed gardens on asphalt. So you can take an old abandoned parking lot and grow crops. As long as you make these raised beds deep enough for root development, he can grow crops. And it's a fantastic way to redevelop abandoned areas. Water, obviously, is an issue. He also has developed a composting facility. So he grows right out of the compost into these areas that you would look at and just say it's blighted. There's nothing that can go on here. It's old industrial land. But that's not... He is showing that if your mind can conceive it, you can achieve it. And it's a fantastic... Oh, it was Milwaukee, I was just informed, is the location of his
Okay, well,
business.
Good enough. It's still the same concept.
It started with an L, so I was in the right direction.
We certainly can do it here. And by the way, I was a presenter at that conference in Hofstra, and I believe they're just starting the committee to do it again next year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I definitely plan to be involved again. And one of the things I really like is edible and medicinal wild plants. Sometimes
yes.
they're called weeds.
Yes.
And they grow without any kind of input from humans at all and are highly edible and medicinal when you know what to look for. So that's another way to increase consumption. Of course, they have to be replaced if everybody starts to understand how to use them and everybody just goes and pulls them out in an unsustainable manner, then you won't have the seed crop for the next year. So it does take a little bit of education.
Yes. Do you commonly harvest purslane?
Yes, that's one of the many plants that I teach people how to pick right here on Long Island. And, of course, that's the highest vegetable source of omega-3s that you can get out in the wild.
That's wonderful. Do you put it in salads or do you cook
it? I do. Mm-hmm. We just put it right in salad a little bit. It's crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
You can also use it as a soup thickener.
Oh.
So it's in any place that I go, I can instantly find at least 25 wild edible and medicinal plants. And there is nowhere I've ever been where I can't do that except one, and that was in the middle of the desert outside of Las Vegas. Oh, that's a very difficult place.
I believe it.
So I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, Laura. Where's a good place for people to go online or by phone to find out more about, let's say, the conference that's going on in October or any other activity of Cornell Cooperative Extension, Nassau County?
I would say our Facebook page is probably the best place to get information. So on Facebook, it's CCE Nassau. And we regularly update that more frequently than our webpage with our
okay.
with photos of East Meadow Farm, and we have a list of all the programs that are coming up, including landscaping and cranberries in October. So all sorts of different programs there. So I would go to our Facebook page for the most up to date programming efforts.
And that's CCE Nassau.
That's right.
On Facebook. And
exactly.
And for those of you who do have Facebook, and for those of you who don't, the landline phone number is 516-433-7970. And you can find out more about Cornell Cooperative Extension, find out how to send them your questions about your curiosity about what's going on in outside your home in terms of plants and insects as well. And I want to thank you so much for your service to the community, Laura.
Well, thank you, Ellen. This has been a lot of fun.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. You can always visit us at prn.fm. And you can also visit the archives and listen to any of the great shows right here on Progressive Radio Network. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai. You can get in touch with me at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next time, we hope that you stay healthy.